This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes, across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today's show, I'm going to be talking about Ben-Hur, War Dogs, Kubo and the Two Strings, and Hell or High Water. I'm also going to be talking about the news, the trailer park, an interview with Gil Birmingham from Hell or High Water, and box office predictions, and of course, the world-famous home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Thank you, Ron Burgundy. The first thing I want to talk about is a couple weeks old, but it's interesting to note, Ghostbusters is apparently going to be taking a $75 million bath when all is said and done, and that's the predictions of how much it's going to make versus how much they spent on this massive reboot, hoping to restart the franchise. And as a result, there's probably not going to be a sequel. They're talking about maybe doing an animated series. But that Ghostbusters launch that Sony was desperately hoping would work, it didn't happen. And a lot of people are out there saying, oh, sexism won. I don't think sexism won on this one. It just wasn't something people wanted. They didn't want a gimmicky remake. There's been so many remakes all over the years. Not every remake is going to do well. Some are better than others. And there are some very good remakes out there. The Thing, John Carpenter's The Thing is the first one that comes to mind. But remaking Ghostbusters, I think, was folly from the beginning. It just sort of alienated its audience from the get-go. And when all was said and done, the movie was okay, but it wasn't great. It was a mediocre remake. It was not a franchise starter. It was like last year's Goosebumps, which wasn't really a remake, but it was trying to start this franchise in. And I enjoyed Goosebumps quite a bit, but it just never really clicked. It happens all the time with movies. They never quite successfully launch. And I think that's what happened. And marketing aside, I think one of the biggest problems this thing faced is that it engaged the controversy in the wrong way. And when you had people who were claiming, oh, girls doing Ghostbusters, Paul Feig and company, everybody sort of went after those. And instead of just letting them sort of spiral around in an internet chat room, they took it head on because they thought that's the right way to do it. But the problem is then they start basically saying, well, if you don't like this movie, you're a sexist. You can't alienate your core audience like that. And they essentially became the Dixie Chicks of summer movies. You can speak out against a group of people as long as you're not relying on them to buy tickets to your movie. And then, of course, you have to then make a good movie that lives up to the original. You know, you wrestle with a pig, all you're going to do is get dirty, and the pig loves it. And that's essentially what the people who did Ghostbusters did. Now, another remake that's coming down the pike that was announced this week is Clue. That's, of course, the movie I remember came out in the 1980s, and I remember seeing it. It was one of these movies, and it was a gimmick from the start. There were like three different endings, and if you went to different, you had to like go to different theaters to get the different endings. Now, when they put it on cable and on VHS, they put all the endings in one film, but it was a neat little gimmick. I don't know if it's defining anyone's childhood, but I know it got a lot of play on HBO. Another big remake that's coming up is Splash. The Disney wants to remake Splash with Channing Tatum as the merman, not the mermaid, and Gillian Bell, who was in movies like The Night Before, and she was also in 22 Jump Street with Channing Tatum. She's going to be playing the Tom Hanks character. Now, I think there's a big difference here. Disney has a history of making remakes with twists. Essentially, Maleficent was a live-action version of Sleeping Beauty with her as the good guy. So they've done this before. It's Disney. And I don't think that Disney is going to let people start to engage in the argument. They're just going to let the argument die. It also, these movies were not ones that defined people's childhood. Certainly not Splash. I've never heard people say, oh, Splash was the defining movie in my childhood. It was a great movie from the 80s, but it wasn't like Ghostbusters. It's not held in reverence. But also, I think in the big scheme of things, we didn't have a Splash 2 or a Clue 2 being promised for decades and then didn't get one. And everyone upset because now they're just going to remake it. This is just a remake. The next piece of news I want to talk about is an interesting little bear trap. Fox Searchlight is in. They're in damage control mode right now over some college rape charges on Nate Parker, the phenom behind Birth of a Nation, which they bought for an unprecedented $17.5 million at Sundance. This was earlier this year. People were talking, this is going to win all Oscars. That's going to be a replay of 12 Years a Slave, where it's the white guilt that's going to drive it to this powerful award film movie. Well, there's a little more guilt involved than apparently just white guilt on this one. Apparently, Nate Parker, back when he was in college at Penn State, which already has a history now of not dealing well with sexual assault. And apparently Nate Parker and his roommate, who actually co-wrote this movie, were accused of raping this woman when she was unconscious. And in her, he was acquitted. Nate Parker was. Now he's come out and said, oh, I was cleared of all charges and I'm innocent. There's a difference between being innocent and being not guilty. Being innocent means you didn't do it at all. Being not guilty means there was not enough evidence to convict you. There's a huge difference. But his roommate was convicted of sexual assault. And he actually appealed and was granted a new trial like in 2005. And he ended up walking because the victim didn't want to testify again, which makes sense in a case like this. I mean, it's a traumatic thing. And then in 2012, this woman kills herself. She's in a drug treatment facility, overdoses on sleeping pills. And while there's no direct correlation in saying this was what she killed herself over, it was certainly something that the family thinks was related and that this incident in college caused her to drop out and kind of fall into this terrible depression. So yeah, this, it's a shadow hanging over him and his movie. And Fox Searchlight did not research this before they bought the movie for $17.5 million and they need this awards push or they're going to be taking that $17.5 million bath. So we're going to see what happens with Birth of a Nation. It's real interesting because in this world today, you've got people like Woody Allen and Bill Cosby and these big names that are having the sexual assault allegations against them. I think people are taking it a lot more seriously. So I'm real curious to see how this plays out. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is Arrival, which will be arriving in theaters on November 11th.
More objects have landed around the world.
This is one of 12.
I'm never going to be able to speak their words.
Got 2 days. Figure something out.
I am human.
It's their language. We need to make sure that they understand the difference between a weapon and a tool. Language is messy, and sometimes one can be both.
I love science fiction, and I think this looks like an interesting movie. It's also directed by Denis Villeneuve, who did Prisoners, and more importantly, Sicario, which was one of my favorite movies from last year. It does look like it could potentially fall into a bunch of traps, because the story is about this woman who's brought in as an interpreter to try and figure out the language of these aliens that have landed. And it does look like it has a tendency to fall into some pitfalls of cliche and preaching. I just hope that it's a steadier hand than the trailers really give a heavy push to certain things. So I'm looking forward to it. I just hope it doesn't spiral into an Interstellar type of movie. The next one I want to talk about is Resident Evil, The Final Chapter, which opens on January 27th.
Alice.
What do you want from me?
Humanity will cease to exist unless you return to the Hive.
I don't trust you.
Behind you.
Everything's led to this.
What are we gonna do?
We're gonna kill every last one of them.
Haven't we gotten to the point where they said they're just going to kill all the zombies anyways? I mean, that wasn't at the point of the last 46 movies they made in this series. I forget how many they've made. I think, what is this, six? There have been so many of them, and they all run together. Every time I look it up, I see, oh, there are that many, and then it runs together again. It is impossible for my little brain to wrap around how many different installments of Resident Evil, because they just sort of fall apart. I think this is six. I think they've made five already. And the last couple ones have really been terrible and just turned into these video games. The last one really literally was kind of going from level to level, having to beat a boss. I mean, it was like you were watching someone else play a video game. I like Paul Anderson's early work. I love Event Horizon. I think that's highly underrated. But he's just turned into a real hack director. So, hey, it's January, so look forward to it, folks. And that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about War Dogs and Kubo and the Two Strings. Because we can, can! Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump right into the movie reviews. I'm going to cover two of them in this segment, and then we're going to do the interviews later. The first one I want to talk about is War Dogs. Two men in their early 20s become weapons dealers for the U.S. government during the Iraq War until landing a huge contract puts them in a pinch.
6 months ago, I was a massage therapist in Miami Beach.
Sorry, it fell.
And now, here I was with my best friend from junior high.
I think you should come work for me.
I'm against this war.
This isn't about being pro-war. This is about being pro-money.
How did two 20-something young men land a $300 million Pentagon contract?
You told me you guys were selling bed sheets.
This is directed by Todd Phillips, who's most famous for doing the Hangover trilogy. I mean, they did three Hangover movies. It's not like this was this brilliant trilogy that all wraps up. It's just they did three movies for it, which is rare to actually have a director do all three like that. It's such high-profile films. And I liked the first and the third Hangover movies. The second one I didn't particularly like, and I didn't really like Due Date. Todd Phillips has a real unlikable edge to him. That's one of the things that I found with like movies like Due Date. It worked in The Hangover because there were such horrible people, but they were buffoonery, and it was like Seinfeld. It was watching people who are not nice people trying to get out of a sticky situation, and it's just kind of fun to watch them be terrible. Or like It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia is another show that would bad people doing bad things and bad things happening to them because of it, and you kind of enjoy that. But this one has an interesting story behind it. Just the concept, and it's all true about these two guys. They're in their 20s, and they decide to become essentially gun runners for the U.S. government. And the reason it works is because the government has to bid on contracts because they can't play favorites, and so these little guys can kind of pick up all these crumbs. But they go for this massive contract, and that's what gets them in trouble. Now, there are some great things about this movie, and first of all, Miles Teller's fine in it. I mean, I don't have a problem with Miles Teller. I mean, he does a good job. But it's Jonah Hill who has a knock-it-out-of-the-park performance. I mean, his performance in this movie is so good, I'm ready to overlook everything else about the movie as long as he gets a little bit of accolades. Because Jonah Hill's the kind of guy that we've always sort of marginalized. Everybody's been like, oh, it's just the fat kid from Superbad. And then you're just like, every time he shows up, he does something really amazing on screen. And he does a great job in this one. So while that's cool and it's an interesting story, it does feel contrived at times. And I'm not talking about the really happened. No, really, these guys did go after this Pentagon contract. Well, no, that's not what seems contrived. What seems contrived is some of the plotting, the way you have to massage a true story to make it fit a narrative of a film and not be kind of like nonsensical and falling apart. And when you don't do that enough, you get a movie that doesn't always quite hold together. It's a real thin line to walk. And there are filmmaking techniques that bother me. They throw in these titles. Like each segment gets a title, and it's a quote that's going to be coming later in the segment. It does play a little bit spoilery, and it breaks up the narrative in a weird way. And there's also a narration done by Miles Teller's character. Now, I'm not a fan of narration in films. I think it's a weak plot device that has been seeded and grown in this world of a post-Grey's Anatomy entertainment landscape where you have to have narration. He's just stating either what's obvious or actually what's literally happening on screen. And there are several times where I'm like, you don't even need a narration on this. You can figure out what's going on here. And the narration just doesn't work. And I often feel that narration is thrown in when a movie's flow isn't done right. And it feels like they may have added this later. The other thing is, and I'm going to pick on her a little bit. It's Ana de Armas, I think is how you say her name. She plays Miles Teller's girlfriend in this movie. And look, I have nothing against her. She is a gorgeous, beautiful woman. And she's not well known in the States. But if you saw movies like Knock Knock with Keanu Reeves, that Eli Roth movie, she was in that. And the problem is she's so gorgeous. She's too gorgeous. She's too gorgeous to play the wife. I mean, she's just sizzling hot, and she's the doting wife, and she's Cuban, so she's got this sexy accent. You're like, oh, no, that's too sexy for this movie. It just becomes unbelievable. It feels like a Michael Bay movie. It feels like a beer commercial because she's so gorgeous. And you get more detached from reality with this loser of a guy who smokes too much pot and is trying to sell bed sheets to nursing homes. Having a girlfriend like that, it becomes almost hard to understand because, oh yeah, I can believe him getting this Pentagon contract, but living with someone who looks like that, no way. In the end, the problems with the movie are there's a lot of duh moments. There's a lot of moments where, you know, I mean, I know they smoke a lot of weed, but come on, they do some stupid moves that are so painfully foreshadowed and that you can see coming from a mile away. And while it may be true, it could have been hidden a little bit better in the narrative. So as punchy and as cool as War Dogs could have been, it really wasn't. So I'm going to have to say War Dogs kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Kubo and the Two Strings. Stop motion animation studio Laika presents the story of a young boy in ancient Japan trying to find magical weapons and armor to protect him from his grandfather, the Moon King, who's trying to bring him home into the heavens.
If you must blink, do it now. If you look away, even for an instant, then our hero will surely perish. It's time to follow my own path. My name is Kubo. This is my story.
Your magic is growing stronger, but when we grow stronger, the world grows more dangerous.
One of the things I love about Laika, and they're the production house that did movies like The Box Trolls and Paranorman and Coraline, is they are not afraid of out-of-the-box stories. All of those movies, those previous films, are very out-of-the-box. They are not just remakes of a fairy tale. They are not rehashes that we've seen a dozen times before. They're always very unique. I mean, The Box Trolls is wacko in terms of its pitch, but it's such a brilliant movie. And I respect the heck out of them because they don't dumb their stuff down. And they continue that with Kubo. I mean, Kubo is, it's an out-of-the-box film, but it's also extremely accessible to mainstream audiences. And in fact, probably more accessible than the other movies like The Box Trolls and Coraline, because it deals with these very universal themes, the Disney themes of family and love and honor and protecting the innocent and doing what's right. And at the same time, it's grounded in its morality and it's grounded in its real characters, but it lets itself soar in terms of its story. I mean, one of his protectors is this talking monkey who is in a sword fight with these sort of like demon women that are actually his aunts coming after him. And it's creepy, but you just go with it. And it is such an out of the box movie. If Pixar were making stop motion animation, they would be struggling to keep up with Laika because Laika is so brilliant. And the animation in this is, I mean, it's so top notch. There's scenes in this movie where I knew took a lot of work and a lot of nuance in terms of animation, and it just is thrown in there, and the average person's not even going to notice it. But they really take an artistry of stop motion and make it gorgeous. It's a brilliant story, very well acted. It's totally worth seeing. It's for kids, it's for adults, it's for everybody. I wouldn't take a little toddler to see it because they're going to get bored. But, you know, like grade school kids, I think can really get into this movie. It's easily one of my favorite of the year. Kubo and the Two Strings totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for this segment. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Hell or High Water and interviewing Gil Birmingham from the film. There is something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kuykendall Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue with our movie reviews. I want to talk about Hell or High Water. A pair of bank robbers in Texas try to make enough money for personal debts without hurting anyone, but the Texas Rangers on their tail might prove otherwise.
Those banks loaned the least they could so they could swipe your mama's land. They took everything from your family. This is your chance to take you back.
On the ground!
Paying them back with their own money?
Well, if that ain't Texan, I don't know what is.
You hear about these bank robberies?
I may have one hunt left in me. They know exactly what they're doing. They're trying to raise a certain amount, that's my guess. I think I got these boys figured.
This is essentially a modern Western. It's what the Western has become when you don't have horses, but you have cars. And you don't just have a Winchester rifle, you have semi-automatic weapons. So this is, in its essence, it's a Western. It takes place in the vastness of Texas. I'm not talking Dallas or San Antonio, way out in that area that a lot of people don't drive through. It's a very depressed community. It's a area hit hard by poverty. In particular, still recovering from the recession that tore through this country almost 10 years ago. And this is the movie that sheds a little bit of light on that. You know, wherever your political stance is on this, you've got to understand that there's a reality of people who are still dealing with this. The banks may have gotten bailed out, but your average person didn't always get the bailout. In fact, most of them didn't. And some of them are still struggling and have been victimized by certain ways of lending and situations that are present in today's society. This movie addresses those issues and addresses a creative way of these two guys who wanted to try to get their way out. But while they're trying to do it in such a way that's not going to hurt anybody, you know, they're hitting banks in the morning right when they open and there's no customers and they just want to go after insured money and they launder it, which is actually, I had this idea once. In my days when I was younger, thinking of creative ways to make money, they take the money to a casino, get chips, and then go and cash those chips in, and then it's untraceable because it just goes into this casino sink, which you can do out there in Texas because there's so many Indian casinos. And it's a brilliant concept, and I'm sort of sad that somebody else took that because that was going to be my retirement. But that is how the planning of this works. But of course, there's always a loose cannon. Chris Pine plays the more pragmatic bank robber, and Ben Foster plays the unhinged, sometimes dangerously unhinged bank robber. And we see that actions have consequences. Even if you try to be as nice and good as possible, you can get into some very violent and very dangerous scrapes, and you can impact people's lives severely when things do escalate. And especially in Texas. Texas is not the place you really want to be robbing banks because everybody has guns in Texas. You know, if you want to rob banks, go up to like Vermont, you know, when they have stricter gun laws. But as well planned out as this movie's characters do, their things, it's not always as well planned out as possible. But it's a well-made movie and it's very strong performances. The real strong performances by Jeff Bridges as one of the Texas Rangers, and he's paired with Gil Birmingham, who most people will recognize. You may not know him by name, but he's in the Twilight movies. He's probably most recognizable from the Twilight movies, playing one of Jacob Black's family members. But he's also in The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. He plays the father of Jacqueline, who's the socialite who actually is Lakota Sioux, played by Jane Krakowski. So I guarantee you, you've seen Gil Birmingham before, and he's a great character actor, of Native American descent. He's Comanche, and I'll be talking to him in a minute. Let's just give a grade real quickly for Hell or High Water. I enjoyed it. It's somewhat depressing to watch, and it's a heavy movie. But it's a well-made movie with good writing and very good acting. So I'm gonna have to say Hell or High Water kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Now let's talk about Gil Birmingham. I had a chance to talk with him a little bit. There's a little bit of sound issues on the line, but with that said, here's me chatting with him, not just about the movie, but about Native Americans in movies and the impact that he hopes this has in his career and elsewhere. Being from Texas, and you're Comanche, right?
Yes, I'm Comanche.
There's a lot of good-natured ribbing between Jeff Bridges' character and you. Did that bother you, or was that some of the sort of friendly insults that went back and forth?
Well, the character was half Comanche and half Mexican, and I have other blood mixtures as well. But I think it speaks to the nature of the relationship much along the lines of the way family sometimes ribs each other. But it was an opportunity to present the cultural aspect of the Native world in terms of having compassion and understanding. Mm-hmm. You know, I understood he was doing the ribbing and stuff, but sometimes I'd respond to it, sometimes I didn't. I'd have my own jabs, but very often, very much like family members do to one another.
Do you feel that it's getting better for not just the portrayal of Native people in Hollywood movies, but opportunities as an actor rather than just being sidelined in? Do you see things opening up for Native Americans?
Well, I do, and I think this is going to be kind of a banner year. I know there's projects in the pipeline now coming down that are involving Native stories, and the portrayals and representation really has a lot to do with the responsibilities that either the writers bring to it or the actors themselves and determining things that are appropriate. A presentation, I would say, an education more so, to counter, you know, stereotypes that have kind of been pumped out for the last 100 years.
In the movie specifically, what was it like working with Jeff Bridges? Because you worked almost exclusively with him on screen, correct?
Yeah, that was such an honor. I feel like, Jeff and I did a movie by ourselves, sort of, you know. So we got to spend a lot of time. We did pre-production things where we hung out for about a week together. And we had so many things in common, music being, you know, one of the bigger ones. And we had just such great discussions. You know, he's kind of a Zen type of guy, you know, spiritually and philosophically as well as I am. So it was such a blessing.
There's a strong-handed message about poverty and what's happening with banks and what's happening with loans. Do you think that that's an accurate message? Is that something that you think is underrepresented or overrepresented or maybe even not quite represented the proper way in everything else we see in the media?
You know, it's not just banks, I think. Although that was the instrument that was used in this script, but I think there's just a sense in this society now that it's just corporations in general and how they've grown to the point of losing their humanity and how the rest of us are feeling as a result of that. You know, the powerlessness we're feeling for conditions that we're finding ourselves in, no fault of our own, really. You know, the devices of an economic system is not operating from a humane way.
Since we're talking Westerns, what's your favorite Western?
One of the greatest compliments, I think, for this movie has been a reference to No Country for Old Men.
Ooh.
And I love that, but I think I got started with the Clint Eastwood movies, you know, the good, bad, and the ugly kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, even Dances with Wolves, I think, would fall under a Western category. It was beautifully done. And then the old ones, you know, I remember Paul Newman and Albrecht. But there's some great ones.
Is there anything else you want to add about the movie?
I hope that it creates a scenario where people will have these kind of discussions and debates about the level of humanity that we have toward one another. Because Chris Pine's motivation, you know, is to provide for his family. You know, the reason my character is in the Texas Rangers is to provide for his family. The humanity, getting back in touch with your humanity and having respect for each other. And hopefully they'll be entertained as well.
And even with good motivations, some very bad things can happen, too.
Yeah. I mean, there's severe consequences to be paid for visiting violence as a solution for anything.
And a big thank you to Gil Birmingham for coming on the show. If you want to hear the full interview, it's like about 15 minutes, you can go over to the fatguysofthemovies.com website. It's posted up there. Enjoy it, and you can listen to it. It's in its entirety. There may be a very minor spoiler near the end, so check out the movie first. Take a chance. It's out in wide release. So that is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be reviewing Ben-Hur and then talking about the box office and the home cinema roundup. Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's take a jump into the past. Look at Ben-Hur. Just start off with the trailer. There's a lot to say about this movie. In this remake of the 1959 classic, a Jewish prince is sent into slavery only to return for revenge.
How long were you a slave?
5 years.
What is your name?
Ben-Hur. My family was one of the most respected in Jerusalem.
Please, I need you to tell me who our enemies are.
Miss Allah, I won't name names. Until we were betrayed. By my own brother.
The world you live in is Rome's. Their laws, their power.
I won't let Miss Allah go unpunished for what he's done to us.
This is one of those movies where it's actually not a remake. I know I'm calling it a remake. Everybody is. Technically, there's some rights issues they've got to deal with because MGM has the rights to the book, which came out in like 1880, and they already made a movie in the 20s before they made the Charlton Heston movie in the 50s. When MGM sold their library, the Ben-Hur remake from 1959, which is actually a remake, had fallen into Warner Brothers' hands. And so Warner Brothers owns it. Warner Brothers wasn't going to make the remake. MGM was working with Paramount to do it. And before people start complaining about remakes, you have to realize Ben-Hur itself is a remake. So the 1959 movie is, in fact, a remake. So yes, there are movies that are remakes that are good. Now, granted, the 1920s movie, it was a hugely different time in Hollywood's history. They couldn't do it the way they do now. But remaking it now, or actually reimagining it, going back to the original book and adapting, readapting the book, I guess you could say. You know, I was expecting this movie to be terrible. I watched Ben-Hur with my kids over the weekend before I saw this, just so it'd be fresh in my mind. And we're watching this and I was like, this is such a great movie. I said, how are they going to remake this? I mean, it's 4 hours long. It's got an intermission. It stars Charlton Heston. I mean, the effects back then were astounding. And yeah, the ocean battle is a little goofy because you can tell they're toy boats. But I mean, the chariot race, I mean, you don't get better filming than that chariot race. Even today, you watch a chariot race from 1959 and it is jaw-dropping. And so I said, this is going to be terrible. So I took my son, my 13-year-old son, and we went to go see it. And it's not terrible. That's the thing. I think that was, we were sort of surprised because it wasn't an awful movie. It wasn't a good movie, but it wasn't awful. It actually was watchable at some points, and the chariot race actually is kind of cool. I mean, it has some moments where the CGI breaks down and they try to do a little bit too much. They put GoPro cameras in different spots at times. Like if you do a movie like Hardcore Henry where it's all shot on a GoPro, I get it. It works. Or an action scene that's GoPro, but cutting from, anamorphic widescreen to a GoPro camera just is so jarring, it just doesn't look right. The handheld nature or the wobbly nature of a GoPro camera, it breaks the scene up. It's not a good moments of those scenes. But it hits all the beats. In fact, they go more into the history, the personal history, and the interaction between Miss Allah and Judah, who, which with their relationship, which they kind of gloss over in the 1959 version, I see what they're doing and trying to go more about, do a little bit more with their interaction. They also put a lot more Jesus in this movie. And how do I say this without offending anybody? In general, I'm not a fan of faith-based films. And it has nothing to do with the content. It has to do with the quality of filmmaking. Generally, whenever I've seen a lot of these faith-based movies, they can sometimes just be overly corny. And sometimes the writing's substandard because they have a specific point they're going for and they're overly reverent to stuff where they just, the realism is gone. And that's why a movie like Risen, which came out earlier this year, I actually thought was a really good movie because it felt like a historical movie that just happened to be from a faith-based angle. And I'd like to see good faith-based movies, well-made, not crap like Fireproof, which is garbage, or God's Not Dead, which is just terrible. You know, something that actually has some realistic dialogue and realistic actions to it. Mark Burnett and Roma Downey, who did The Bible and they did Son of God, which I was not a fan of because it felt like a TV movie you put on the big screen. They produced this, and it's pretty clear, and even though I think there was a quote from Mark Burnett, who's basically saying, we got to get kids involved in this stuff. So let's make a summer tentpole action movie, and then we can put more Jesus in. And I'm paraphrasing, of course, but that's kind of what they do. And what was, I thought, so neat about the 1959 version is it was very much that corny 50s Christian-based filmmaking. But they had a more gentle hand with it. I always liked the fact that Ben-Hur took place with that as the backdrop. It wasn't a movie about Jesus. It was a movie that took place where Jesus kind of swerved into the film here and there and impacted the characters greatly, but they were all very peripheral to him. And there's a little bit too much of Jesus in this where it feels like it's trying too hard. And like the scene from the Garden of Gethsemane. How do you ever have anyone deliver a line like who lives by the sword dies by the sword and not have that sound goofy? It just doesn't work. It feels almost corny. It feels like something you'd watch in Sunday school as opposed to something you'd see on a Saturday afternoon in the theaters. They proselytize too much and it kind of brings the quality of the movie down. Now, the other problem is this movie has no stars to it. I mean, oh yeah, they got Morgan Freeman. It felt like Mark Burnett and Roma Downey were like, let's redo Ben-Hur. But let's find a way to cast God in the movie as a character, at least his voice, and then just more Jesus. Morgan Freeman's in the movie, and he's a good actor, but it's so obvious they expanded this role for him, and he like teaches Ben-Hur to chariot race like a weekend. Whereas in the 1959 movie, he was already a championship chariot racer. You know, he had been doing that for years, and that's what made him so good. And it feels like they felt that the stars, Jack Huston and Tony Kebbell, were going to be stars when they cast it. It reminds me a little bit of the Point Break remake that came out last Christmas, where there's no stars in it. They had these two guys, I think what, Edgar Ramirez and Luke Bracey starred in the movie, and they both were, they're, I think when they made that movie, when they made Point Break, they're like, oh, these guys are just getting started in this career. By the time this movie comes out, they're going to be big stars, and they never took off. So you ended up with a movie that was a tentpole release at Christmas with nobody that anyone recognizes. And I think that's a part of the problem with the Ben-Hur movie. You're going from Charlton Heston to that guy who was in Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, or the guy who played Dr. Doom in that really terrible Fantastic Four movie last year. That's the essence of the casting of this movie. Still, it's passable, but it just feels like a why bother. If you want to see a good Ben-Hur movie, go block off 4 hours and watch the 1959 Ben-Hur. If you want to see a mediocre one, you can go pay $10 and go see this. But still, it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. The Suicide Squad won again last week with exactly what I said it was going to win with. I said it was going to be around $45 million. It ended up making 43.5. So it was very close. It's having a little bit better staying power during the week than Batman versus Superman. But I think that has more to do with the fact that school wasn't in session during these weeks and Superman versus Batman, they had a school in session. So they really kind of had to stick to their weekend numbers. I think now that kids are all going back to school, you're going to start seeing those midweek numbers go significantly lower, and that's, you know, what was going to save this movie. I still think Suicide Squad has a chance to win this weekend, $23 million. The big question is whether Ben-Hur can bring out the faith-based crowd, which is what they were obviously going for. I saw it in the paid showing, and the people there certainly looked like they were there to see a remake of Ben-Hur, and it wasn't just somebody swerving in there. It wasn't like teenagers or anything, but it wasn't like big groups either. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. We'll see if anyone can drag people to bed. Ben-Hur's tracking like $15 million, which is not good for it. It's a $100 million budget. Kubo and the True String should be making $100 million this weekend, but it won't because there's a lot of people who won't give it a chance when you should. Shame on you for not letting Kubo win this week. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. The Angry Birds movie finally hit DVD and Blu-ray. That one was okay. I wasn't terribly impressed with it. God's Not Dead 2, which is the horrible sequel to the horrible God's Not Dead. And then from TV, you've got Once Upon a Time, Season 5, the ABC show that I'm kind of surprised is still in the air. Gotham Season 2, about Bruce Wayne and his family before he became Batman. And then The Vampire Diaries Season 7, if you want to catch up on all your teen angst and vampire woes before the next season starts. And then finally, this is a little bit of a fun one, is The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension is available on Blu-ray from Shout Factory. Definitely worth checking out because it's such a bonkers 80s movie and totally worth seeing, even if you don't understand one frame of the film. And that's it. I need to go for the week. And when I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Don't Breathe and Mechanic Resurrection. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.